Possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, welcoming three of the most distinctive voices in jazz today, Herbie Hancock, Michael Brecker, and Roy Hargrove, for their Directions in Music series and exploration of jazz of our times. For more information or tickets, visit KrannertCenter.com.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne, is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking with novelist Peter Carey. He has authored a number of books. They have been popular successes and critical successes as well. He's gotten a lot of awards for his work. He is, in fact, one of only two writers to have won the Booker Prize twice, first in 1998 for Oscar and Lucinda, and then again in 2001 for his novel True History of the Kelly Gang. His new book is a work of nonfiction that is an exploration of the worlds of Japanese animation and graphic art. And it all started with the interest of his son, Charlie, who was 12 years old at the time, who was fascinated by Japanese comic books and movies. And it was an interest that both father and son came to share, and the two of them went off together to Japan. For Charlie, what he was hoping to do was meet some of his heroes, but for Peter, he no doubt was hoping to come away with maybe a better understanding of the Japanese and Japanese culture. And as you read the book that Peter Carey has produced, the title of the book is Wrong About Japan, A Father's Journey with His Son. While the son gets his wish, it's much less certain that the father gets his. The book is out now, been out a little while. It's published by Knopf, and it's in the bookstores if you want to read it. Questions are certainly welcome here on the show, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So 333-9455 for Champaign Urbana folks, and we do also have a toll-free line, 800-222-9455. And at any point here, if people want to join in the conversation, you can certainly do that. Mr. Carey, hello.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Great.
Thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it. When you were growing up in Australia, what did you know about Japan? Were you at all interested in Japan? Was it on your radar screen?
Oh, well, you know, I'm 61. So I was born in 1943, and my country and your country, too, were at war with Japan. Mm. And so I guess, you know, I grew up with my mother telling me that the Japanese were coming to invade Australia, but the Americans stopped them at the Battle of the Coral Sea. And I grew up playing with Japanese occupation money that had been bought back by kids' fathers who'd fought with the Japanese in New Guinea. And I grew up also in a time, you know, where there was really quite violent anti-Japanese feelings in Australia. And also at a time when something being made in Japan, I guess, would be thought of to be substandard, you know, that they were cheap toys and so on and so on. And in fact, I think it was not until about 1970 that, you know, advertisers, say, in Australia would start to use the word Japanese as something being synonymous with quality and something was well made. Mm. So that's a really different time.
Did Charlie's interest, was this something that he came on independently himself? Did it have anything to do with you?
No, it didn't really. There was a movie that he found at the video rental place, which was not an animated film at all, but it was a live action film with this rather wonderful Japanese actor called Beat Takashi. And Beat Takashi always, you know, has a sort of little twitching eye and a sort of a funny walk, and he always plays these sort of thuggy characters. And this was a story about this thuggish guy, played by Pete Takashi, and this little kid. And the pair of them set off together, the thug not being very interested in having the kid along, and I think the idea is to find the little boy's mother. And in the end, of course, they bond and da-da-da. But the boy is rather quiet and shy. And anyway, it's a charming movie. And what I started, Charlie rented it once, and then he rented it again, and then he rented it a third time. And I thought, this is really interesting. He loves this movie, and why does he love it? And at that time, unless I know, Charlie was very shy, and the boy in the film, I think, was sort of quiet and polite. And I thought, well, maybe Charlie's seen some country unlike New York City where it's fine to be a little shy and to be a little quiet. But and he turned to me one about the third viewing, and he said, Dad, could we go to Tokyo one day, to Japan? And I said, sure. And I said, sure, thinking, well, one day. But I also said, sure, thinking that I'd like to do it because I'd been to Japan twice before. Each time had been quite different visits, but it'd been hugely enjoyable. And so I said, sure, but I didn't really think we were going to go as quickly as we did.
Mm-hmm. How did you think about this sudden fascination, his sudden fascination with Japan?
Well, I don't know. I think you always like to see your kids almost getting interested in anything that's and particularly in things that they want to talk about with you. You know, in interests that don't involve going to close the bedroom door to play video games by themselves seem to be a good idea. So it was. I was pleased by it, and as his interests broadened, I mean, he discovered, you know, Japanese animated films, anime, and he discovered Japanese comic strips. I was also really interested to look at them with him because, you know, I think graphically, frame by frame in the movies and in the comic strips, I thought they always looked really, really good. And sometimes even if the subject matter was not wildly intelligent, still, you know, the graphic style of them was very appealing to me too. So I wasn't exhibiting a sort of a false or interest in looking at them with him. You know, it was a genuine interest. And the questions that I started to ask weren't even necessarily driven by some desire to sort of teach him, it's curious to think, here am I, an Australian father with an American son, and we're watching this Japanese work on television, and what are we understanding about it, and how different is that from each other, and how different is our understanding from people in Japan watching it?
Yeah. Well, all through the book, there's this contrast between the way that you view this and the way that he does, and that it looks as if you're being, and you know, being the grown up writer dad, are being a little bit more analytical about it than he. It makes it look like he just thinks it's cool, and of course it is. You do too, and at the same time you're also thinking about it, saying, well, no, this is really interesting, and it's a window into somebody else's culture, and what can we learn by looking at it? Although I guess what I'm interested in it is, over time, whether you felt that he indeed, on his level, it was more than just, isn't this cool? I mean, also thinking about what it was all about besides just being cool?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the thing that you've got to be aware of here is that you're talking to a novelist. And when, you know, really, we can't lie straight in bed. So that's our job. That's Daddy's job, darling, I have to tell you. So there are ways you've got to look at this and say, well, the character of Charlie as put on the page is my characterization of Charlie, and the characterization of myself put on the page is my characterization. And I'll push things a little bit, and I'll exaggerate things a little bit. And there's something else which I have to come to about this, because I have a character in the book that I made up,
mm-hmm.
and I have to confess this.
I'm glad I get near
a microphone, I have to confess.
I'm glad you did, because it was something I wanted to talk about, and yet I don't want to blow it. I didn't want to blow the secret. So now that you've outed yourself, good. we can do that.
Good. Sorry, so that's made me forget totally what the question was.
I guess I was interested in the characters that you present of yourself and him, and of the dad and the father, and of the cool guy, and of the analytic guy, and you're sort of saying, well, in a sense, I'm a writer. These are characters, but that they do reflect the approach, the kind of way that both you and he approached it. But I am interested in his at what sort of levels he was really appreciating this stuff too.
I think the thing that Charlie most wanted was just to go to Japan. And he would do anything to do that. I mean, he would eat raw fish and squishy things and whatever he had to do to get there, he was up for it. If we had to go to meetings that which he knew we were going to do that he might find boring, that was fine with him. And what the book represents is that really he did really want to go and just get cool stuff. Mm-hmm. If I was going to write a book, it had to be more than just collecting cool stuff. And so in my pursuit of it, I was thinking of, well, what would make this an interesting account, to think about where all these little things in Japanese popular culture came from in Japanese history, and to think about that, and to ask ourselves and to question. Now, so that's true of us, and we really were like that. But then there were times, you know, when Charlie really would enter into this. And sometimes he was just a reluctant, lazy little boy, and sometimes he was truly engaged. And there's a thing I talk about early in the book, which always sounds a little shocking, but we used to go backwards and forwards from Manhattan, where we lived, to Brooklyn, where Charlie goes to school. And so there's plenty of time in the city on the subway, and we talk about this. And I'd drawn to his attention that, you know, Commodore Perry, you know, was the American who opened up Japan for the trade with the world and so on. And one morning, Charlie said to me, "Dad, do you think if Commodore Perry had not gone to Japan, well, do you think they would have dropped the atomic bomb? Well, it would have been dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki?" And I'm sitting there thinking, God, this is working. I'm thinking, smart kid. Like the idiot father that I am, but you know what I mean. I'm thinking, well, this is great. You know, that's an interesting question. How would I know? I don't know, but, well, maybe not. And so then he said, turned to me and he said, "Well, no Godzilla." So, because, you know, and that was something that we'd both learned during this thing, you know, Godzilla, which we, you know, think of as just, you know, Japanese monster movie, really was a very self-conscious response to the horrors of Nagasaki and Hiroshima. The comment can sound rather callous, but it does come from sort of him engaging with the notion of where things in popular culture comes from. So it's a long answer, I'm sorry, but he did start to think about a lot of these things.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Peter Carey. He's a novelist. He is the author of 8 novels. His most recent is My Life as a Fake, and a new book that is nonfiction, sort of, and it's titled Wrong About Japan, A Father's Journey with His Son. It's published by Knopf, and it is, as we have explained, this sort of the story of his son and his son's fascination with Japanese animation and graphic novels, and about how Peter, as a result, kind of got interested in them too, and about how that gave the two, dad and son, something to share, and about how they went to Japan together so that Charlie could pick up some cool stuff, and that Peter could also do some investigating and thinking about Japan too, and spend some time with his son. It's a lovely little book. It's out now in a bookstore if you'd like to read it, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. One of the things that really struck me was very early on in the book when you are talking with Charlie about going. And Charlie says to you, "No real Japan. You've got to promise. No temples, no museums." He did not want to do that kind of touristy thing where you would go to all those sort of traditional places. And you did pretty well, although you did drag him to the kabuki.
Yeah, well, I had to. I mean, he's not going to get a pain-free ride. I took him to the kabuki because, yeah, kabuki had been in it, even though now, you know, you go and you see all of these very proper Japanese grandmothers in their kimonos out for their afternoon at the theater. You know, the kabuki really was almost at the level, it was sort of actually kabuki itself, I think, means deviant, or, you know, it's got some sort of rather outsider thing to it. And kabuki was a little bit like anime and manga, you know, not quite proper. And, you know, the kabuki was often relegated to, you know, its own areas outside of where polite and proper society took place. And my memory of having gone to Kabuki was that it was loud, lively, and full of action. But sitting beside my son in the Kabuki theater, you know, for what was to be a four-hour show, I suddenly realized that my previous notions of, you know, fast, funny, and entertaining were not his. And he squirmed and complained and generally thought he was in kid hell. But anyway, that's the only bit of real suffering he really had to endure.
Well, it sounds like he hung in pretty well.
He was good.
It sounds like he was pretty good sport about the whole thing.
Yeah.
I mean, given the fact that the whole rest of the trip was kind of about what he wanted to do.
He said, "One, I mean, anybody who's got a 12-year-old kid, just listen to this, I think. When we're jet-lagged, you know, and so we wake up in the middle of the night, and he says, 'Dad, are you awake?' I said, 'Yes.' He said, 'Dad, I'm really happy.'" And I can't think, I've got two boys, one's 18, Charlie's now 14. I don't think none of them have ever said, "I'm really happy." And then he had this other response, which I do remember one day walking along the street with him in Tokyo, and he said to me, "Dad, when my band fails, I'm going to come and live here." And I said, "Charlie, you don't have a band." And he said, "I know, Dad, I know, but it's a rite of passage." Now, when you think about this trip and what the effects of this trip, well, you know, Charlie's got his band. He's got a gig in Red Hook, Brooklyn next weekend. And he's been studying Chinese for 2 years and is ready to study Japanese next year. So I think there probably have been some bigger consequences of the trip than I had imagined at the time.
Well, we can make that into a MasterCard commercial where it says, you know, the cost of going to Japan, XXS, the value of having your 12-year-old boy tell you, "I'm really happy," priceless. And, you know, maybe that really is, any dad who's got a teenage boy probably would appreciate that.
Well, I think we were lucky.
One of the things in one of the reviews that I read about the book, the reviewer says that apparently you have talked about or are working on a new novel, and that it's said to be set in Japan.
See, this is the trouble with all these classifications of fiction and nonfiction, because that appeared in a newspaper, right?
In the New York Times, and yeah. I don't know, what do you want to say about the veracity of what you read in the Times anymore?
It's complete fiction. It's not true.
It's not at all true.
Somebody told me about this review. I've not read it, but I do know that the reviewer was particularly concerned with what was true and what was not true. And it's a shame. It's a shame that he went to a newspaper to find the truth, because he's not well informed.
Well, and the reviewer is another. It's Marcel Theroux, and I assume that he's one of the Theroux's, or maybe not.
No, he is. He's Paul Theroux.
That was my assumption, and indeed in this review he does make reference to the fact, as you talked a little bit earlier in our conversation, that there is this character that you introduce in the book that turns out to be that you have made him up. And so, yeah, Marcel, I guess he was kind of, overall, I think his review is positive, but he did seem to be kind of concerned about, well, okay, is this a work of nonfiction? Is it fiction? Can a nonfiction work have a fictional character in there?
Yeah, well, I think they're interesting questions. I think that probably that the book should say, you know, a mix of fiction and nonfiction. It probably should say that on the flaps. It doesn't. I would never reveal that the person, I will reveal it today, who the invented character is. And I feel all sorts of different things about this. I mean, I think, you know, I don't want to trick readers. It's not why I'm doing things. I invent the character because it's I'm a novelist. It's this character whose name is Takashi is, like, if you like, the clothes line on which I hang my washing. So all of the real, you know, very real things that happened in all the interviews we did are organized in a sense to do with our relationship with this invented kid Takashi. I think that. So I think I'd rather readers know that that's what they're getting into, but I would say at the same time that anybody who reads a memoir who thinks that they're not getting a story told to them, and that the telling of stories or even our memories always involve distortion and invention, you know, I think it's an issue that's worth thinking about.
Well, the way this character is described in the book, it's you set it up that that Charlie has been corresponding with him by email, and he says to you, "Well, Dad, we're going to meet this guy, and he's going to sort of help us and show us around." And I have to admit that I did read this review before starting to read the book,
right.
So I had the cat was already out of the proverbial bag. But somehow, the way this character is described, I would think maybe should be a tip off to the reader that something fishy is going on here, because it sounds like a character out of manga or anime come to life.
Exactly. Well, that's what he's intended to be. And in fact, when I first started to write Takashi, who, by the way, Charlie named, I was writing him as a comic strip character, you know. And then I decided in the end to not make him a comic strip character, but he's still, he glows with light. He's like somebody that's, you know, that stepped out of a television screen. And all of his clothes and his way of dressing is really one of the characters in Gundam, Mobile Suit Gundam. So you read it very, very well, and I thank you.
This gives me an opportunity to talk about this particular anime this animated cartoon feature that is at the time of the book is a favorite of Charlie's, the Mobile Suit Gundam. And maybe people have seen it, has actually, some of these have run here in the United States on
a lot.
So people may have seen them, and also people may have seen some other Japanese animated cartoons, and they may indeed, their question is, what is the deal with the giant robots? Because there seem to be an awful lot of animated cartoons that are somehow one way or another involve people inside these enormous machines, and that is indeed what Mobile Suit Gundam is, basically. Also, aside from the fact that it has this incredibly Byzantine political theme going on, which you could spend years and years just trying to figure out, because it's all this twists and turns and alliances and different, you know, it's this intergalactic war going on with these kids, essentially, fighting battles in these giant robot suits. And I'm sure a lot of people would come to it and say, what is this about? And of course, that's one of the questions you had asked.
I hope you're like, not going to ask me.
What is this about? Well, I know it's, I know you don't have the answer, but I know also that it was something that you asked yourself too. What is this about?
Well, there are so many different issues that are raised. I mean, the whole, like Japanese people say, Japanese people like robots. Well, why? I mean, I have no idea why they like robots. I mean, just recently I read a story about somebody talking to Japanese people about the whole issue of foreign workers in Japan. And as you know, there is a distinctly, let's say, xenophobic aspect to Japanese culture. And very hard to become a citizen of Japan if you're not born there. And sometimes our interpretation and looking at Japanese society, the way it acquits itself, say, with its relationship with Korean people and so on, we would easily call racism. So it was with some interest that I saw in this interview that the Japanese person asked about the need for foreign workers, said, yes, but we will have robots soon who will do all of this. I just throw that in, not because it's an answer, but because there is generally, in all sorts of different ways, this obsession with robots. And I, looking at this, started to wonder about why it was. One of the things I thought was, well, here's Mr. Tomino, the inventor of this series. And I checked his age, and to tell you, I can't remember what it was now, but I saw he'd be a child, you know, at the time of war, just after the war. And so I thought of the traumatic effect of war on you know, young people in Japan, and I thought about, you know, this basically is a war movie. And so within this, the kids are powerful and not victims of war. You know, that they're, so I thought that was an interesting thing to think about. But I also thought that it sort of echoed other things I'd seen in Japanese art, where individuals are isolated from society, armored from society, like, you know, they're sitting inside these steel machines. And that in a little bit of a way, that will also fit it together with these people who are called otaku, who sit in their rooms with their computers and don't really have any human contact with anybody, just with their obsessive little things with comic strips or whatever. So I went to Mr. Tomino with all of these thoughts. Mr. Tomino said to me, he said many different things. One is, of course, he presents himself very much as an artist, but at the same time, he said, the only reason there are robots there is because the series was designed to sell toy robots. And so he then went on to lengthy explanations about his conflicts with the makers of the toys and the size they wanted the robots and so on. And so here you have this thing which appears to be one thing, but is there to sell toy robots. But then you have to ask yourself, well, why do people want toy robots in the first place? So I don't know.
Well, there's got to. I don't know if I'm being overly analytic, but it still has. There has to be something going on that says, well, all right, if we had decided to invent a comic strip to sell toy robots, it would be different.
Yeah.
And that difference should tell us something.
Sorry,
about the difference between us and you know, and the Japanese or whoever else was doing it.
Well, I think one of the things that in my long conversation with Mr. Tomino and, you know, about six of his assistants and five tape recorders and Charlie, one of the things that Mr. Tomino kept on insisting that there was nothing particularly Japanese about what he'd done, and he'd gone out of his way. I was saying, well, to him, well, surely, you know, the way that people speak must indicate class or education or background. He said, no, in Japanese we don't have that. That's you, it's not me. And I said, okay. And he said he specifically made it so that, you know, they wouldn't have any national thing. And so there was nothing Japanese about it at all. And then we started to get into this thing about children in war. And he started to, he launched into this thing about children and war and how there have always been child warriors, and that it's sort of basically, I think he was saying that's unhealthy just to be a victim or in war, that the child has a duty as a citizen. And this is a heavy weight of responsibility. And so suddenly I find myself having this conversation about something that, from my perspective, was really weird. Really, well, different. Not weird, just different. So someone is seriously telling me that children should fight in war, and if they don't fight in war, then it's basically bad for them. And at that moment I said, well, thank you, Mr. Tomino. You really have demonstrated that there is something culturally very different about, you know, this, about your work. And for all of us, it has to be true that where we come from is going to affect our art. And however we make our art is going to, in some way, the soil we've grown up in is going to affect, you know, what we do.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Peter Carey. We're a little bit past our midpoint. We're talking about some of what you will find in his new book, Wrong About Japan, A Father's Journey with His Son. It's published by Knopf, and it is an account of a trip that he took with his son, Charlie, who was 12 at the time, who is now 14, that was inspired by Charlie's fascination with Japanese comic art. Manga is the word in Japanese for the graphic novel, which is really a lot more than a comic book, and also Japanese animation. Some of this we're starting to see more and more here in the United States. Peter Carey is the author of 8 novels. He won the Booker Prize twice, and his most recent novel, which I enjoyed very much, by the way, My Life is a Fake. You can read it. I'm just dying to ask you about My Life is a Fake, but I'm not going to do that. 333-9455 is our Champaign Urbana number, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just to go a little further, I really liked the story about you talking with the man who came up with the Mobile Suit Gundam, and about how ultimately you did get to a place that maybe provided an answer to that question, what is this all about, and how different are we really, and from where do those differences come? You did title the book Wrong About Japan.
Mm.
Did you feel that ultimately you went there with a certain set of ideas that turned out not to be correct? Did you come home with a little bit better understanding, or did you feel that when you left, your lack of understanding was about where it was when you started?
Yeah, well, Well, I think a number of different things. I think that it's the nature of life that we're all going to be wrong about each other anyway. And if I can think of so many of my novels, you know, and the way that they're told and how people misunderstand each other, that inevitably that's going to happen. And I think if you're going to go to another country, and let's say you read about it for 5 years, and I read about it probably for 6 months and spent, you know, had two different trips there, how could I possibly be really right about anything? But what's more interesting is our struggle to understand. And that can be very interesting. And it is, after all, a very common thing that we have in travel, continually. And our experiences of trying to understand, not quite understanding, understanding a little bit, giving offense, misunderstanding. So that all of that was really, I think I can write about that because that's sort of that's within my range. Being truly right and having any big insights, I don't think is going to be really within my range. But I'd say that the thing that I felt at the end of it, when I'd finished it, I had thought, and I think about this particularly in relationship to the book's publication or lack of publication in Japan, that if somebody, I thought if somebody was going to come to the United States, some Japanese person, and completely get it wrong, but with some humor and wonder, but I think we would not be uninterested. I think the Japanese sort of seemed to, the Japanese publishing seemed to fall out of love with me. Firstly, with my novel, My Life is a Fake, which happened to deal with partially with the Japanese occupation of Penang. And suddenly, where there was some, you know, there were war atrocities committed in Penang. And, of course, atrocities happen on all sides at all times, alas. But this was about Japan. I couldn't get that book published in Japan. Hmm. And this book, no one wants to publish it, it might be just for the reason they say, which is that the things that I'm fascinated by are really ordinary for Japanese people, or it may be that there's things in there that are sort of offensive to Japanese people or things that they don't want to think about. And so I think the thing that I came back with when it was all over was I thought of it as a country that was more sensitive and vulnerable to criticism, which is something I would expect of Australia. We're hugely, hugely touchy about what people think about us. But I wouldn't have really expected that so much to be true of Japan. Hmm. And I think that a really, really deeply, opaque nature to the culture, so that when, for instance, afterwards, I'm trying to find, I don't mind they're not going to publish my book. I mean, maybe it's just of no use to them, but to try and find out why, no matter how drunk my agent got various publishers, was impossible. So they'd get out totally, totally drunk. You see, I'm going to take him out and get him drunk. We'll find out what all this is about. And all that would happen at the end while they're staggering to the company car would be to say, Japanese people not like this book. That's what I learned.
All right. Well, let's talk with... we have someone who'd like to talk with you. We'll do that in Champaign, line one. Hello.
I'm very interested in your book. I haven't read it. I actually study Japanese studies, and I teach a university course on Japanese culture.
You're the person that should have written the book.
No. But I study historical Japan, so it's a very different story, but very interested in Japan. My wife's Japanese and so on. But it's very interesting, though, this interest of your son in Japan.
Mm.
And this is something I've noticed, that sort of historical curve over the years, that in my youth, you know, there was this sort of mystique of Japan with regard to, to some extent, martial arts is still, you know,
yep,
the association with martial arts. And then, of course, you know, you have this, interest in Zen and, you know, meditation and this sort of association with some mysterious quality to Japan. But something I really wonder is, though, this, you know, that fell by the wayside with the 80s and the sort of, you know, the automobile Japan image that was, you know, very, very strong. But with the 90s, you know, and up to the present, I'm not sure your listeners realize, I think you do, but the extent to which someone like your son and someone like my students have an utter fascination with Japan. And I really wonder whether there is a kind of orientalizing aspect to this, insofar as Japan is like the sort of ideal postmodern, very, very different other, that is very different from George Bush's America. I mean, utterly different, right? And it's not a liberal place. There's nothing liberal about Japan, but it's something utterly other. And I just have an interesting story for you. I was talking to a student about 4 years ago, and he's an Asian American student. A lot of Asian Americans have fascination, of course, with Japan, but also, you know, students across the board. There are probably, you know, I know there were several hundred students in the anime animation club here at the university.
Yeah.
But this student told me, he said, you know, I'm not like this, he said, but the majority of students are studying Japanese now. You know why they're studying? He said the reason they're studying is they want to be in Japan when the new game software comes out. So they can speak in order. Yeah,
yeah.
He was completely serious. And it was mind-boggling, right?
But I mean, I'm of course I have to be shocked, I guess, but I'm not surprised.
Right.
And I think that would be not a, you know, a million miles from my 12-year-old. I mean, I hope to hear something better from him.
Right.
You know, in a couple of years' time, but and now he doesn't even want to talk about it. So, but yes, I know it's incredible. I mean, that's Charlie's notion was what we were going to do is look at cool stuff.
Right, and so he's lost the bug then? A lot of people never lose the bug.
The good thing, I think the wonderful thing from he is he's no longer quite as interested in anime. He reads manga occasionally, but he's been, having come back, he couldn't study Japanese. He studied Chinese for 2 years, and he's going to do Japanese next year. So something quite substantial occurred.
Yeah, and well, I mean,
I don't know what it is, really.
Yeah, on the one hand, I mean, I see there's this orientalizing aspect of this. On the other hand, it's a wonderful thing if he's very interested in Asia. You know, it doesn't have to be Japan. And so I find it very, very interesting. One thing to note, though, about gadgets and so on, you know, this interest in robots, and I think it's a very complex problem, but that, you know, as you were talking about the post-war, you know, era, and on the one hand, I mean, Japanese people are associated with an interest in detail, and smallness and small, you know, very, you know, handy objects. And so there is this general, you know, at least association, not always true, but with a very great interest in gadgets and so on. But at the same time, there is, I think, a kind of real fascination among them, speaking apart from your son and a lot of Americans, that there are there is in Japanese culture very commonly a fascination with, well, actually not so much fascination, but actually a respect for something like anime, manga, and aside from this issue of gadgets and so forth, just a fascination with sort of creating another graphic world. And I think there's a whole history behind that. I'm not really a scholar of that sort of study, but there's a real fascination with that, and people not realize that you will typically see, and I've seen, you know, 50, 55-year-old men sitting reading Jump, which is a magazine, an anime, a manga magazine for 14, 15-year-olds, and they're not embarrassed, you know, and of course, then they'll have historical novels like The Tale of Genji, you know, in multi-volume series in manga. And people will buy these in the droves, you know, in various historical and other series. So there's no embarrassment, no association only with kids. So I think that's something that, you know, a lot of Americans don't realize.
We tend to think of comic strips as being something that are read by adolescent males, pretty much. And I mean, it's not quite true, but certainly young girls have traditionally not bought many comics, and there's very little comic market left for American girls, I think. And the adults certainly didn't read comics. But in Japan, of course, as you know, the comics or manga are for everybody and for all sorts of them. Young girls and girls read them, and women and men. And this, you know, and as you said, you see these very conservative gentlemen in suits, salary men coming home at the end of the day, you know, reading big, thick comic books.
Right. And of course, I mean, this may be related to issues of, you know, creating fantasy in everyday life. And Japanese society has a series of socially complex you know, problems just as we do, but very different. And so, you know, finding a sort of out beyond simply the company.
No, absolutely. I mean, and one of the things that I was talking of outs in that way was, you know, in a way that Japan, maybe more than anywhere, you are what you wear. and like other countries, the Japanese have very strict rules about what anybody could wear depending on their rank and so on. And these days, there are these people who really love to dress up big time. And you know, at Harajuku, you see all these kids and their fastidiously detailed, perfect punk, you know, Sid Vicious look.
Right.
And you also find people. I didn't meet this guy. I only heard about this guy, but he was a friend of a friend who dressed on Friday. He was a salary man, but on Friday nights he dressed in the clothes of a traditional Japanese carpenter, and he had a carpenter's van, and then he would go off and pick up girls.
Ah, that's not at all surprising. Yeah, to have this sort of
carpenters have money, right?
Fantasy life he could create.
Yes.
Very, very common. And of course, it's related to the metropolitan character and wealth of Japanese society that they can get away with this in a sense. You know, creating these lives for themselves of a time they can't create. So this is only on Friday nights. This is probably this is a big problem. But anyway, thank you very much.
Right, well, thank you. It's nice talking to you.
Thanks for the call. Let's go to line number two for someone here on a cell phone. Hello.
Hi. I just wanted to ask if you might discuss the pornographic manga, which one sees everywhere, and they read it openly, men, on the subways, and with no embarrassment whatsoever. And also I remember from when I was in Tokyo when you would see these adult women, and they would all dress in sort of the schoolgirl style. Mm. And giggle and things like that. And if you might mention that whole aspect of the Japanese attitude towards sexuality, I guess that would
well, be. Well, you know, firstly, I don't know what lines you were traveling on. But we certainly had some. The otaku, the person who was is the greatest expert on Gundam Wing in the world. Is a transsexual, and we had very serious meetings with her in the publishing house. I mean, clicking across the foyer in her high heels, and well, all the Japanese men continued to call her or he and so on. And she said to me in an answer to a question relating to some of these things, you know, the Europeans are so frightened that if they take the clothes off, they'll turn into werewolves. So they have a notion of us as being particularly uptight. But as I said, I'm not an expert on this, but this was my experience. The thing about the... Somebody else said to me the other day that they're traveling on subways and seeing all this pornography being read in front of them. It was not my experience. I'm not saying it's not true, but I just didn't see that. And I also thought that... When I first started doing this, in the United States particularly, there was that manga in some quarters was almost synonymous with pornography. And what I thought, correctly or not, in Japan was that the pornographic aspect of manga was in proportion. You know, a percentage of all manga, and I don't know what that was, but you know, I saw plenty of most of the manga I saw in trains and whatever wasn't pornographic, which is not to argue with your experience, of course.
I'm going back. I'm thinking back to the first caller, and I guess I was also thinking about myself and my childhood. I think as a 12-year-old boy, I also was fascinated by Japan, and maybe that was because being a little bit younger than that, like a lot of little boys, I was fascinated by medieval Europe, and it's not that much of a leap, you know, from medieval Europe to medieval Japan.
No.
I guess I do wonder what over time, you know, what sort of continuity there is in the fascination with Japan for 12-year-old boys or those of us who still have a little bit of 12-year-old boy left, and is there some sort of continuity in that kind of fascination?
That it would continue to happen.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I was I'm going to sort of slide off the question just a little bit to one side. You can bring me back. And it just suddenly occurred to me, and actually from things you have said and the other callers, that when you're thinking about Japan now, which, and this is not about the medieval aspect of it, but to think about the highly developed and sophisticated use of graphic visual language, which you really, you know, do see it there. And if you think of the degree to which our children now, are really way more interested in this sort of information than they are with reading novels, for instance, you can see a very good reason for them to respond to this particular world where the graphic novel is so highly developed and so well done. So, and if that's the case, then one can see that going for a long time.
We have another caller. Let's do that and talk with him. Someone here on our line number one, someone in Urbana. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Mm-hmm.
I got familiar with the word manga when I was interested in Hokusai's 15 volumes of drawings.
Yeah, yeah.
From 1830 to 1849. Yeah. And it sounds like you're using the word manga the way people use the word Kodak. You're referring to every small book that has pictures in it.
Well, manga means, actually, doesn't it mean something like a silly doodle in the beginning?
Well, it means drawings, yeah.
Yeah.
Little drawings.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm well aware, yeah, that the word was used in the 19th century. Maybe it was used in the 18th, for all I know. And it has a sort of a slightly self-protective irony about it. I mean, to call it a silly doodle.
Well, in those days, they also had many pornographic books of the same size.
Yeah.
But, for instance, in the 15 volumes of Hokusai, mm-hmm. there is not one single erotic design.
Mm. But it's interesting. It's interesting you should talk about that particular work, because don't you think that often that, you know, looking at, you know, contemporary Japanese graphic novels or manga or whatever you want to call them, that you do see the heritage of that sort of line, you know, of those woodblock prints?
Yes, I'm sure there is. Yes, of course, yes. Well, thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Others listening, if you'd like to call in, we do have just a couple minutes left. If you'd like to give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You talked a little bit about the fact that maybe Charlie's interest in manga and anime have cooled a little bit, although he's still continues to be interested, apparently, in East Asia, to the extent that he's studying Chinese and would like to go on and study Japanese. So for him, this may indeed be some kind of enduring interest. You never know when you're that age. But I guess I wonder whether you think this, in the larger scheme of your relationship with him, this is a chapter that's going to remain very important.
Well, I think we were just damn lucky, you know, that I think it's this is always this. I think I'm blessed for myself to have been able to write this book and take that trip, and it really was, in my recollection, a magical moment, and we'll remember it. I mean, I think as kids we mostly forget everything that happens to us, or forget many things, and I know he won't forget this, I won't forget this, and it just happened when he was 12. See, by now at 14 he wouldn't want to do it probably.
He's now into the age where if you're walking down the street, he'd prefer that you were walking several paces behind.
His brother was a little like that. Charlie's not quite like that. But, I mean, Charlie's now working on his band. He's working on looking cool.
He's busy. He's got stuff to do.
He's got stuff to do. So, you know, and any Tokyo nightclub that he might want to go to, he's going to have to wait a few years, and then I'm not going to be allowed in with him anyway.
I talked a little bit earlier. I asked you about the fact that there was this reference in a review of the book to your writing a novel set in Japan, and you said, no, it's not true. But I'm sure that every experience he or she has is potential for coming back somehow.
Oh, you know what? The characters, it's not set in Japan. The characters do pass through it. I think there's about two small chapters.
Okay. Well, are there other ways that you think that this, in one way or another, will end up and direct you into thinking about certain things, or maybe to want to explore certain things further?
It's hard to say. You know, my ideas for novels mostly come out of an idea that leads me somewhere. So I figure if that's so, then this must be so, and then I should do this and invent that. And in the case of the novel I'm working on right now, it involves, once again, sort of fraud and theft. It's called A Theft, A Love Story. And I discovered some things about how people sort of different ways when you have stolen paintings or suspect paintings, and ways in which they can sort of be laundered by moving them through Japan.
Hmm.
And so I was interested in the art world and the art market and these things. And then, you know, there's a way to so that I can, you know, do something. And it's set in Tokyo. Well, you know, I've been to Tokyo now three or four times. I feel not unconfident with a bit of research in doing that. So it isn't Tokyo that leads me there. It's a story that it's a story about something else where I see an opportunity to use something I know.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to stop. I want to, again, recommend to folks, you might look at the book we've mentioned. It's titled Wrong About Japan, A Father's Journey with His Son, by our guest Peter Carey. Also, he has authored several novels. His most recent is My Life as a Fake, and something new coming out soon you can look forward to. Mr. Carey, we want to say thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. It's nice talking to everybody. Thank you so much.
Our show, Focus 580, made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates this year, celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. The broadcast also made possible by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Urbana. The staff there at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting AM 580. That's it for us here on Focus. Of course, we want you to stay tuned. There's much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. And the host is Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk about dogs with dog trainers Carol Lindholm and Jim Keel of the Dog Training Club of Champaign-Urbana. Let's take a look at now at what's happening on the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. March, wheat 288 and a quarter, down 1.5. May, 296 and a half, down 2. March, corn 195, that unchanged. May, 203, unchanged. July corn 210 and a quarter, down 1/4. December 227 and a half, down 1/2. March beans 499 and a half, down 2.5. May 501 and a half, down 2.75. November 521, down 2.75. March soybean meal 149.50, down 1.20. March oil 1892, up 6. March feeder cattle 99.65, down 15. February live cattle 90.95, that down a nickel. February lean hog 70.75, down $1. February pork bellies 88 even, up 7.5. March Brent crude 44.08, up 23. The CRB 281.57, down 4. The U.S. dollar 84.19, up 26. And the Dow is up 57 points at 10,650.